From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Amy Sedaris, star and co-creator of the Comedy Central TV series Strangers with Candy, the untraditional after-school special. She plays a 47-year-old ex-con, ex-prostitute, ex-addict, bisexual high school freshman. Sedaris has also written and produced plays, including a few she wrote with her brother, writer and public radio commentator David Sedaris. Also, the history of Mediterranean cuisine. We talk with food historian and cookbook author Clifford Wright. His new book is A Mediterranean Feast. And TV critic David Bianculli gives us his take on this year's season finales. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attorney General Janet Reno said she was surprised by a report showing that congressional investigators had managed to get through security at federal facilities by posing as law enforcement officers. The General Accounting Office said its investigators used fake badges and IDs obtained from the Internet to bluff their way into 19 government installations, including the FBI and the CIA. The investigators also got into Reagan National Airport in Washington and Orlando International Airport in Florida. In most cases, they got through security after flashing their badges and saying they were armed. Federal authorities are beefing up security. Hurricane-force winds and rain hit North Carolina today. They blew down power lines and left tens of thousands of people without power. Mary Hartnett reports from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill.
Two tornadoes touched down in central North Carolina this morning with 80-mile-per-hour winds snapping trees that pulled down power lines. Nearly 160,000 people in the Greensboro area are without power. The violent winds also brought down a small plane in Chapel Hill, injuring two people. Tom Ditt of the State Division of Emergency Management says the biggest danger is from live downed wires in the streets.
This fast-moving line of thunderstorms created havoc from Winston-Salem and Greensboro all the way into the Triangle area. We had widespread damages from trees down, power lines down, debris blocking roadways, things like that.
North Carolinians are still recovering from last year's Hurricane Floyd. For NPR News, I'm Mary Hartnett in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Ethiopian authorities are still reporting heavy fighting on the central front of their war with Eritrea. John Ogolnik reports from Ethiopia.
Ethiopian government spokesman Haile Kiros says Eritrean forces are fighting as they retreat. He also says a division, about 5,000 to 6,000 Eritrean soldiers, are surrounded near the town of Sirona. About 150 peasants left town to return to their villages. Some of them said they walked a day and a half to help, but the Ethiopian army told them they weren't needed at the front. People around Adigrat are watching TV reports about Eritrea's retreat with great delight. In a local hotel bar, one man said he was happy to see the Eritreans out of Zalambessa. For 2 years, he says, the people of Adigrat were shelled off and on by the Eritreans and were forced into bomb shelters. He added, "You can't imagine what it feels like as a civilian to be shelled." For NPR News, I'm John Ogolnik in Adigrat, Ethiopia.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 211 points, or just over 2%, to close at 10,323. Declines led advances in moderate trading of 975 million shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 65 points, or nearly 2%, to close at 3,205. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary William Cohen says he's disappointed with his top spokesman for releasing information from Linda Tripp's personnel file to a reporter. Tripp helped trigger the independent counsel investigation into President Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky. The Pentagon's inspector general said spokesman Kenneth Bacon and one of his assistants violated the Federal Privacy Act by giving a reporter from The New Yorker information from Tripp's personnel file in 1998. Tripp is suing the Defense Department for revealing the information. The astronauts aboard Space Shuttle Atlantis are about to start the final phase of raising the International Space Station to a higher altitude. The maneuver is needed to position the station for the arrival of a Russian crew cabin. Pat Duggins has more from member station WMFE in Orlando.
The astronauts will undock Space Shuttle Atlantis from the International Space Station late Friday. That's the last docking the station will see until July. That's when the school bus-sized Russian-built Zvezda crew compartment is scheduled to dock by remote control. The Russian space program plans to launch the module on an unmanned Proton rocket. The last NASA astronaut to make a long-duration space station flight was Andy Thomas. He spent 4 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. He says even small things were memorable, like how the air smelled.
But I did notice that when the shuttle came to get me and I was going back and forth between the vehicles, the air in the shuttle did smell fresher. The air on Mir smelled a little bit like going into someone's basement or something like that.
The space shuttle lands early Monday morning. The next shuttle docking mission is scheduled for August. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Sales of existing houses fell sharply in April. The National Association of Realtors said sales of previously owned houses dropped by 6.2%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. This is how one critic describes Strangers with Candy, the Comedy Central TV series starring my guest, Amy Sedaris. It's a celebration of bad taste, political incorrectness, and biting satire, with a high school freak show setting and a cheesy cult movie ambiance. Amy Sedaris plays Jerry Blank, a 47-year-old ex-con, ex-prostitute, recovering drug addict, high school freshman. A teenage runaway, she's returned to Flatpoint High to finish school and learn life's lessons again. Sedaris co-created and co-writes the show with Paul Dinello, Stephen Colbert, and Mitch Rouse, comedians she first met during her stint as a member of the Chicago improv troupe Second City. The idea for the show came from a documentary film Dinello once saw called A Trip Back, about a 50-year-old prostitute and drug addict who turned her life around and began a career as a motivational speaker for high school students. The team started with this premise and then combined it with their warped, satiric take on the after-school special, those half-hour morality teleplays ABC churned out in the 70s for latchkey kids about drug abuse, peer pressure, broken families, and other traumas of adolescent life. Here's a clip from a Strangers with Candy episode about risking unpopularity by going out with the new kid at school. In this scene, Jerry, played by Amy Sedaris, is in a golf cart. Don't even ask. She's with the new kid, Ricky. They're making out when Ricky has a sudden revelation.
Remember how I said I never met my real mother?
Yeah, that's too bad.
I think maybe I just have.
Oh, my dear Lord.
Why, Mom? Why?
Look, you have to understand. I was a teenage runaway for 32 years. I did things I wouldn't force on a mule. And that includes things I forced on a mule.
You just gave me away?
No, no, never. I traded you for a guitar. God, and all these years I've wondered, what happened to that guitar?
Do you even know who my real father is?
Of course I do, of course. Florida, 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 Florida. See, it was either this obese bail bondsman with a hair lip or a Cuban. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a Cuban because there were thick as flies down there. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is we're together now.
You just can't waltz back into my life and be my mom.
Well, maybe I can be a friend.
That would have been great. But I'm transferring out again. My foster dad just got a new job.
No, I'm gonna let you go. Not now, not again.
Well, I have to.
All right. I guess it's for the best. Seems I don't have a job or any maternal instincts. But at least I know you'll be out there, not relying on me.
Goodbye, Mom.
Well, can't we still make out?
What I remember about those shows were they were just so dripping with concern. I mean, even as a really young kid, I hated them. Do you
yep.
Do you remember watching them?
Yes.
And actually, I mean, the window in which you take them seriously must be about 3 minutes. I mean, yeah,
exactly. We just make fun of them. And the terms they would use were always really queer, which fits for us because we're all in our 30s, and we don't know what the kids are talking about now. So we just go with whatever terms we know, and they must be pretty queer, you know? So We're pretty unhip ourselves, so it's just kind of funny how we just are not in the know.
So what conventions did you mine in coming up with some of the plot ideas? Certainly the getting in with the popular crowd is a...
Yeah, that's always a big issue. And then we'd come up with a story idea, and then we'd say, okay, what would happen in a real after-school special? You know, morally, we would just try to figure that out, and then we would just try to, you know, find our twist on it. Let's see, we're writing new episodes now that deal with, I find out I'm part Indian. So I go to this Indian camp and find out that I'm part Shingo Beak, and I have to deal with that. I find out that we're going to do a musical on homosexuality. STD. And I have to tell all the people that I slept with, which could take episodes. What else have we got cooking? Oh, mental illness. I found out my mother's lover is mentally crazy, so I'm dealing with that, too.
And, of course, you always have to be just absolutely politically incorrect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the fun part.
I mean, that must be a rule for your sessions.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's amazing. Some things we can't get away with and some things we can, but Comedy Central's pretty cool about it.
The show is, though, unusually raunchy. I remember an episode in which you, as Jerry Blank, referring to your state of sexual arousal, says, you say, I'm as moist as a snack cake. I
right.
couldn't believe I was
it's
listening
a snack
to
cake
TV.
Down there. Yeah.
Do you ever?
I guess so.
You ever get any get in any trouble with the censors? Is there such a thing as censors? Censorship.
Yes, they do say. Yeah, we give them the scripts.
Central.
Yeah, they do, and they tell us what we can and can't say. But some things we just seem to get away with. but we don't sit down and try to be offensive, or we don't try to be dark or anything. That's just our sense of humor, which is good for all, you know, three of us. So we're not just out to do that. But, yeah, sometimes they'll slap our hands and say, oh, you can't do that.
Physical comedy is really a huge part of the show and part of the problem of talking about it on the radio. But Jerry's looks really come under that category. She has some kind of overbite. Grimace.
Yes. And those are my real teeth too.
I was going to ask you that. You wear your hair in this weird, outdated, futuristic, or many styles of two-tone swirls up and off the side, and you're thin, but pear-shaped, and seem to have too much hip and thigh heft. It's really really
well, I wanted
pretty
a body.
Ugly.
I wanted a body that is just different than mine, in that I like it. I just wanted to be, you know, small on the top and large on the bottom. And I don't know, I just feel it's just Jerry's very sexual, and I just wanted that kind of body for her. You know what I mean? Because you never get to see a body like that on TV, really. And as far as my wig goes, which first of all is $1,700, and second of all, I wanted to look like a golfer, had the head of a golfer. And then clothing-wise, I went to this woman who does the wardrobe. Her name's Victoria Farrell. All I told her was I wanted to look like I owned snakes. And she just nailed it. They're so good. The wardrobe on the show is, and they hand make things. But I just like the fact that they're crafty like that. Like, they'll actually make the dresses for Jerry or earrings, and I love that. You know what I mean? Like, they're good. They're good like that.
Do you wear padding on your lower body, or just clothes
yeah,
that
I have
fit
two fatty
really
suits.
Badly?
Oh, you have... No, I have two fatty suits on. My dad's real weight conscious, and so I had a fatty suit made for my body, and I wore it home to fool him. At Christmas time for a couple days, and it worked. And so that's what I wear on the show.
That was years ago, before this whole mm-hmm. episode? You had a fatty suit just made to play with your dad's head?
Yeah. And I didn't have enough money to get the top part made, so I just had it from the waist down. You know, so I had one of those bodies where you could pick up somebody from behind a bar, but the minute you walked around the bar, you could watch them take off. Where you going? Yeah, and it's great. It's just so nice to have a different body.
Well, the funny thing about getting back to Jerry Blank in the show, the funny thing about this character is that she's really pretty unattractive, but she thinks she's attractive, and she's very into sex, and she's very comfortable with her body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a typical scenario. In fact, you hardly ever see that on TV, that the not pretty girls aren't supposed to be at ease with their sexuality.
All my characters like themselves. I mean, that's one thing they all have in common. I've never played anybody who didn't like themselves. You know, even, I don't know if there's this character David writes, we have in the plays named Piglet or Tula Sackett's where I tape my nose up. And she's horrific looking. And every other word is just a dirty word. But, man, she just loves herself. You know, she wears bikinis and she's just thinks she's hot. But her face is just hideous. You know, I don't know. I just find it easier to play it that way. I like people who like themselves, you know, and it's just enjoyable to watch.
Now, this is somewhat related, but maybe not. I know you once showed up at a photo shoot for Paper Magazine, which has a special edition of the 99 More Beautiful People. Mm-hmm. And you were one of them, and you showed up at this photo shoot with a hatchet and makeup to look like a battered woman.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I didn't know the issue was on 100 Most Beautiful People. I had no idea that was what the theme was. And I would never have photo shoots. I try to think of, okay, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? Because a lot of times the photographer isn't prepared. They just, you know, they want you to come with some ideas. So I just thought I would like to look beat up because I just look great and be really happy about it. So, yeah, I brought a makeup artist with me, and he made me look beat up, and it looked so real. Man, it looked great, and I paid him to do it. So when I walked home, and I as if people were looking at me like I was pretty, you know what I mean? But they were looking at me because I was all beat up, and then they would turn away. You know, it was really interesting to have that many people stare at you. And then I was waitressing that night, and so I wore the makeup to work, and only one table asked me how I was doing. They said, "Are you okay?"
Why
I was
did
like,
you?
Yes, I'm in love, and she's great. I just couldn't. I just broke my heart. I didn't. I paid the guy like $150 to do it, and I wasn't about to go home and take it off.
I'm talking with Amy Sedaris. She's an actress, a writer. She's one of the co-creators and co-writers, and the star of the sitcom "Strangers with Candy," which airs on Comedy Central Monday nights at 10. Comedy Central calls it its untraditional after-school special. We'll talk more, Amy, after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Sedaris. She co-writes and stars in Strangers with Candy, a TV series on Comedy Central, which parodies after-school specials. Your brother is David Sedaris, who's really...
My older brother. Thank you. Go on.
You're older. You're very old, and you, very young, have an older brother who's well-known to... He's well-known to the public radio crowd as a frequent contributor to This American Life. He's also an author... a best-selling memoir. Did you watch after-school specials with him and Cut Up?
I don't remember watching after-school specials with David. I do remember watching that program that would come on Sunday with the puppets. What's it called? Not Kukla. Is it Kukla Fun Ali or something? Kukla. Remember that show?
Yeah,
puppet,
right.
And the Lamb Chop.
Right.
I watched that with David, and they would show old movies, like that Fatty and Skinny movie and the Red Balloon. I watch shows like that with David, and I love Lucy, and I watch shows like that with him.
So you were close growing up?
David and I, he was the one, when we were younger, he would always do, like, characters and come up with, like, little movie scripts and stuff for us to act out when we were little. So we were close like that.
Did you put on real shows in your basement and charge admission?
Yes, we put on plays, and then, like, if The Wizard of Oz was on TV or To Kill a Mockingbird, we would charge tickets, and, you know, people would come down in our basement and watch it. My mom would make a cake, stuff like that.
So did you think you were going to become a performer? Is that what you wanted to be? Because I think I read something about you wanting to be a cop.
I wanted to be a cop, and I wanted to work in the women's prison in North Carolina. I was just fascinated with the prisons and criminology. And then it dawned on me that I could just read those books or just play those parts. So I knew I wanted, you know, I just knew I wanted to perform, but I didn't really think about it till David called me one day and said, you know, you really should move from North Carolina and come to Chicago. There's a place here called Second City. It's perfect for you. So that's what I did. And then everything just happened from there. I got in and toured and started writing shows.
Who were the other members of Second City when you were there?
When I was there on main stage, it was Bonnie Hunt was on main stage and Mike Myers. When I was hired, I was hired with Chris Farley and Tim Meadows and Paul and Steve and Greg, who were all in the show. And Ian Gomez, who's on TV now. It was like all six or seven of us were hired at the same time. So it was a pretty good year.
You left Chicago, moved to New York. David was already living in New York. Why did you move?
We were working on a play, and I just decided, okay, now what I really want to do is live in New York. I just couldn't go from, you know, North Carolina to New York. It would be too severe. So I just decided, okay, now's the time to go to New York City. We were doing plays anyway, and so we did a play called Stitches, and that's when Comedy Central approached the cast and said, hey, you want to do a sketch show? So ever since then, we just kind of fell into TV.
Well, now as adults, when you and your brother write together, is it the same process as when you were kids putting together shows?
Yeah, it is. We just, David's very disciplined. Where a lot of people say a lot of times improvisation is a lazy way of writing, but I'm more up on my feet. You know, David writes something and then he can hand it to me and then I get up on my feet and I act it out or add to it or improvise with it and then he'll go back to the typewriter and it's kind of like that process. But he's definitely, you know, more the writer. You know, it's our minds write it together. But it's a little different. I don't know how to explain it. A lot of times we don't really say no to each other, David and I. We just, any possibility. Like, okay, and the mother shows up on a horse. Okay, great. You know, we'll just go with it. It's fun like that. But he works really hard. You know, it's so nice to work with someone who's really going to go home and work on it some more when you just want to go home and sleep or whatever. So,
well, you seem to have a real physical sense of humor. I can't really say that David doesn't. I've never seen him read his stories or perform, but you do seem to specialize in that visual comedy. How did you develop that?
I don't know. I've always been that way. When we do plays and stuff, I'll ask for a door frame. We gotta have a door on stage. I just want a door on stage. And then once we get the door on stage, it's like I need something just to be like, okay, now I'm gonna go through the door. You know what I mean? It's like I like to be surrounded by, I love props and I love like real furniture on stage. And then you just find stuff and you play with it and just kind of, I'm not like an actress. I can't say I love you or I lost the baby or cry without laughing. You know, I'm just not good at it. So I'd rather physically try to find a way to find humor.
Since your comedy is so physical, I'm curious if there are any comedians you look to as an inspiration or you really enjoyed.
I'll tell you, I really go for more dramatic performers, people who can cry on the spot and stuff, like Helen Mirren or people like that. And then I always look at those people and think, okay, now how can I make that funny or, you know, physical or humorous or whatever. But my heroes, whatever, aren't comedians. Like, you have to drag me to a comedy. You have to drag me. And then when I go, I have such a good time. Like, I loved Bullfinger, that movie. Is that Bullfinger, something like that it's called? Eddie Murphy in that. It was so funny. And I saw Jim Carrey. You know, I've seen him do some stuff, and he's makes me laugh really hard.
Bowfinger.
It's a Bowfinger. Oh, I love that.
And
Steve Martin.
Why do you hate going to comedy shows, though?
It's already supposed to be funny or something. I don't know. I just go thinking, all right, I just don't like to laugh as much as I like to. Like, even my choices in books, I like serious, you know, like serious stuff. Because I guess it's because I can't do it or I don't, you know, have the tools to do it. But originally when I came to New York, I did this thing at a theater called Laughter Through the Tears, where I mounted Night Mother and Come Back Little Sheba. And I stuck to the script. I just did it more character driven, you know, like funny characters did the play. But, you know, and people would still laugh and cry. And it was great because I knew I couldn't do what Sissy's Basic does, you know, but I wanted to do that part so bad, you know, that play so bad. But again, I also pitched that as a TV show. I thought Night Mother would be a great sitcom. You know, like each week the girl tries to kill herself a different way. But it could be humorous. So that way I like, you know, I like to think of it that way. But again, when I go to a comedy, then I'm like, ah, okay, that was funny, whatever. You know, but it's usually not my first choice, or am I inspired by really funny, funny people.
Now, you also have another career, another job. You're a waitress, right?
Mm-hmm, I still waitress. Mm-hmm.
Even though I assume you don't really need the money at this point, right?
Well, no. And I do it because I always, like, what else am I going to do on a Thursday night? I mean, I love making money, and I have my whole life. Like, I like making cash. And it's great working out. It's Marion's on 4th and Bowery, and I make really good money, and the people who work there are really cool. And I also make cupcakes and cheese balls on the side, and I'm doing pretty well with that little business of mine.
You sell them?
I sell them. I make them and sell them, and when I do plays, I sell them in the lobby. And people order them from me, and like I sold 4 cheese balls. I did the Conan O'Brien show a few weeks ago, and I was talking about my cheese balls, and I got 4 phone calls, and so I sold 4 cheese balls, and it's great because it's something to do with my hands at 3 a.m.
Are these the things that are cheddar and port wine or something and have nuts all over them?
Well, maybe that's your recipe, Barbara, but my recipe, I make a traditional, and I make a smoky cheese ball. One's got A1 sauce, A1 steak sauce in it. Yeah, they're great. Cheese balls are great.
Uh-huh.
So and I'll make those.
When you sell them, are you in character?
No. No, it's me. It's me doing it for the money. You know, I'll stay up all night frosting 150 cupcakes just to make, you know, $150. You know, and all the money goes in a big mayonnaise jar I have a rabbit named Tattletail, and all the money goes into her jar just to, you know, for her food and stuff like that. So it's my business, Tattletail.
Amy, it's been a lot of fun talking to you. Thank you very much for coming on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Amy Sedaris, Strangers with Candy, airs Mondays at 10 on Comedy Central. Here's another clip from the show. Jerry is talking with the high school gym teacher, Coach Wolf. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Jerry, I'm giving you a chance to reclaim your virginity.
What?
Reclaim your virginity. It's a new movement. Girls all across the country are getting a second chance at purity by becoming chaste.
What are you talking about, Coach Wolf?
I'm talking about giving the damn thing a rest, Jerry. Look, if you want to reclaim your virginity, let your Fertile Valley lie fallow. Start thinking like a virgin. Hey, Barbara, wait up.
Well, I can do that. Don't think about sex, don't think about sex, don't think about sex.
Hey, Jerry.
Lou!
I was wondering.
Wondering what, If you could get me behind the dumpster, hike up my skirt, and pound home, well, I'm a virgin now. And this is one blushing rose you are not gonna deflower.
I just wanted to ask you to a movie.
A movie, huh? Maybe we could, I don't know, sit in a balcony, and I could take a bite out of your candy bar while you poke around.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Time. This week in Time magazine, Wireless Summer. A look at the new internet-ready phones, pagers, palms, and pocket PCs for communicating outside of the office. And Random House's Dial Press Division, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling the country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, did Marco Polo really bring pasta from China to Europe? We'll talk about the history and culture of Mediterranean cuisine with writer Clifford Wright and TV critic David Bianculli on this year's season finales. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Clifford Wright's new book, A Mediterranean Feast, is a little hard to classify. Although it's this year's winner of the James Beard Award for Cookbook of the Year, it might just as easily have been categorized as a cultural history text or gastronomic travelogue through time and the lands of the Mediterranean basin, including Spain, North Africa, Crete, Sicily, the Balkans, Turkey, and the Near East. The book is over 800 pages long, with 500 modern recipes rooted in the history of the regions. There are more than 6 different recipes for salt cod, dozens for sausage, salads of duck gizzard and tripe, as well as perennial classics such as cassoulet and hummus. Clifford Wright is the author of a number of cookbooks and writes for many gourmet magazines. His unique approach to cuisine began during his earlier career in international relations when he worked at Middle East research institutes. Today, we think of the Mediterranean as a lush place, but in his new cookbook, Clifford Wright notes that that's a relatively modern development. I asked him to describe the Mediterranean diet in the 5th century, where his book begins.
It was very basic and very minimal, and it was a subsistence diet. The Mediterranean in the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries was very much like the Somalia we read about today, where people are perpetually starving. Famines were constant. The diet consisted of not much more than found wild herbs, some cabbage, gruel of various kinds, some bread. But starvation and the misery in general was so pervasive that there really cannot be said to have been a cuisine. Not really until the advent and rise of the Islamic era, when you have a real golden age of culture, and in fact an age when the Mediterranean is more or less saved from the dark ages that resulted after the fall of the Roman Empire.
In this period, were meals differentiated? Was breakfast different from lunch and dinner?
Only at the very, very highest levels of society, among the very rich and among the rulers. The common people, which represented probably 95 to 99% of the population, basically ate whenever they could eat, and that was not often.
So for breakfast, what did people normally eat when they scraped something together? A kind of soup, which is,
again, it would have been something like some kind of sops, which is a just stale bread soaked in water. Sometimes the food was so poor that water would be boiled with some stones in it in order to give it some kind of earthy flavor. But there was no nutritional value whatsoever. And it was only later, as new agricultural products began moving into the Mediterranean, that not only was there more food on the table, which also leads to an increase in population, which also leads to the development in number of cities, which gives rise to new classes of people who create wealth, which brings us up to today, of course.
I didn't realize there was this interesting play or a vicious cycle, really, between the Black Death, the plague, and famine cycles. And you point out that rats who hosted the fleas that transmitted the Black Plague during the Middle Ages were attracted by the grain stores kept in case of famine.
Yes, it's a terrible circle of death, really. But the grain stores were kept to fend off the problems of lack of food during plagues, except that the rats would contaminate the grain stores. Incidentally, people have often thought that meat consumption was very little during this period of time. And in fact, the opposite was true, because meat stores couldn't be contaminated by rats to the degree which grain stores could. So meat consumption rose. But the other reason that meat consumption rose in the late 14th century after the Black Death is because so many people died. Some estimates are 50% of the population of Europe was dead because of the Black Death, that there were fewer people to work the farm. So as the farmland reverted back to meadows and forest, you found an increase of animal husbandry, meaning there was more meat and fresh meat. So freshly slaughtered meat was very common on the table at that particular period of time. And then later, of course, meat consumption dropped again as this kind of wave and flux that continued throughout the Mediterranean over the centuries.
Now, in general, even in times of prosperity or not famine periods, people like soldiers and servants, according to your account, lived on very little. I mean, it's just astonishing reading your history what they could do with their day, given how austere their diet was.
It was really incredible. I mean, the best fed people, of course, were the clergy who had access to food. The very, very rich rulers had access to food, but not always. Sometimes their tables were as sparse as their servants. But the best fed were certainly the sailors who worked on the galleys, and their physical activity was such that they needed that level of calorie intake, which basically matches the kind of calorie intake you would find today. But that was very, very rare. For the most part, people weren't eating, and were most families lived below what is considered a starvation line by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization today. I can't remember the caloric figure, but it was very low.
Now, did people come up with justifications for the great differences in class and in the diet between the classes? Did they believe that the rich, for instance, and the poor had different digestive systems?
Yeah, it's really kind of an interesting thing. Much of the understanding of dietetics in the Middle Ages came out of a theory that was originally developed by Greek doctors during the era of classical Greece and Rome. And it was thought that the rich had different stomachs than the poor, and therefore they required and needed different kinds of food, especially fine foods. Whereas the poor, because they were so coarse as human beings, their stomachs were also very coarse, and therefore they really should only eat coarse food, meaning, you know, junky food, turnips, cabbage maybe, and other poor grains like millet or sorghum. Whereas the fine wheat would be eaten by the rich because it was more suitable to their stomachs.
So what changed to make life easier then in the Mediterranean? And I think you point to the Arab influence in the Middle Ages.
Well, what I try to do is pick three, I really talk about three major historical events or epochs that influenced the kind of food that began developing in the Mediterranean from the modern era on, the modern era being about the early 18th century on up until today, and what makes these cuisines so wonderful today. The first is what I call the Arab Agricultural Revolution. One scholar called it the Medieval Green Revolution. You have to remember that about this time in the 8th and 9th, 10th century, the greatest civilization at the time in the Mediterranean is the Islamic civilization, which is really quite new. It's only a couple of hundred years old. And the Arabs, as they expanded their influence into the Mediterranean, made a number of enormous changes, especially in the areas of hydrology and irrigation, bringing a new agriculture that made land more productive. And some of these food products are very important, such as hard wheat, which led to the development and invention of macaroni and couscous, hardtack, which is known as ship's biscuit also, and other foods like rice, which is very important, became a staple in some countries, sugar, eggplant, spinach, and a number of other vegetables. Then the second great epoch fact that happened was the age of exploration, which was tied in to the development of the Renaissance. The Renaissance came about as a result of this increase in population and the rise of cities. With more cities and a new class of people called the bourgeoisie, who were creating wealth, and the wealth was actually created by virtue of trade, you had the development of this concept of good living, which meant you had the patronage of the arts, music, theater, and of course gastronomy, leading to the development of new cuisines. Without the age of exploration, you wouldn't have all these fantastic food products coming from the New World, which helped alleviate a lot of the starvation in the Mediterranean. The two most famous being potatoes and tomatoes, but a host of others, a variety of squash, beans, and so forth. And what was interesting about this age of exploration, a lot of it was made possible by the fact that crews could now begin taking very long journeys across the open ocean as a result of having storable food in the form of hardtack and macaroni as well, which is a product made from hard wheat, which was introduced by the Arabs.
Now, I don't know if you can put this to rest, but I thought the common myth was that Marco Polo brought spaghetti or macaroni back from China, and that's when that food became common in the age of exploration.
Yeah, it's actually not true. But what's interesting about it, and it should have been picked up much earlier, that is when Marco Polo was in China talking and writing his diaries about what he was discovering, he talked about finding vermicelli. He used that word. And lasagna, and he used that word. Well, if he knew these words, these weren't Chinese words after all. They're Latin Latin derivative words and Italian words. He was already familiar with vermicelli and pasta and macaroni before he even left Venice. And in fact, the earliest very clear reference we have to macaroni comes from 12th century Sicily, which at the time was under the rule of the Normans. And there was an Arab geographer, a very famous geographer named Al-Idrisi, who wrote a book called Book of Roger, where he describes the pasta factory in Trebia, a little town near Palermo, where they were making itria, which is the Arabic word for vermicelli. So it's pretty clear that vermicelli, that is macaroni, which is a generic term for all pasta or noodles, was probably invented some maybe 100 or 200 years before that time in the area of either Sicily or Tunisia.
I'm talking with Clifford Wright. He's the author of A Mediterranean Feast. It's a part cookbook and part history text of the Mediterranean region. It won this year's prestigious James Beard Award. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with food writer and historian Clifford Wright. His new book has just won the James Beard Cookbook Award for Excellence. It's called A Mediterranean Feast. Now, I've read often that this or that food or dish was brought back by the Crusaders to France or to England. Is that another myth?
Yeah, I think it really is. And one of the main reasons is that there were already mercantile contacts between Italian traders in Western Europe before the Crusaders set off on their journeys. There was already contact happening in culinary exchange. In any case, the Crusaders, for the most part, were religious zealots and mercenaries who really had no alimentary interests. They were interested in military conquest. And in fact, they were so awful at agriculture. Their agriculture was essentially subsistence agriculture and not a money agriculture. So they were really not producing any kind of foods that could be transported. It's possible they were responsible for the introduction of certain kinds of spices, such as balm, which was used in church services. But for everything else, very, very little. They were located, for the most part, along the Levantine coast, running from Lebanon, parts of Syria, down south through what is today Israel into certain places in Egypt. And they were very, very limited. Perhaps we can gather a little something about what Crusader cooking was really all about and what their role may have been was during the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, which is the late 12th century. More or less, it lasted for about 100 years. Streets in Jerusalem were named after the people who worked on the street. So, for instance, there was the Street of the Leather Workers and the Street of the Silver Workers. And there was one street where the Crusader cooks worked, and it was called the Street of Bad Cooking. That might tell us something about that notion of Crusaders being responsible for anything.
Well, here's another long-held assumption, that all those spices used in medieval cooking, cloves and the like, were used as preservatives, and also to maybe mask the smell of rotting meat. Is that true?
Well, it's not true for two reasons, and two really quite obvious reasons. One, spices were enormously expensive, so the only kinds of people who would never need to preserve meat are the poor. The rich don't need to preserve meat because they can eat it fresh. They can afford it. Well, the poor are hardly going to use expensive spices to preserve meat. They already have two other sources they can use, salt and the sun. That's one thing. The second thing is, as I mentioned earlier, with the Black Death, you had a situation where meat consumption was always of fresh meat. So there never really was a case where spices were needed to preserve anything. Spices were used to enhance the flavor of food. And that was the main reason people were so fascinated with spices.
Why are the medieval dishes so sweet, or is that just a modern misconception?
No, it's they are sweet, and they're very spicy. There's enormous amounts of spices used in some of these dishes for the rich. Now, I'm not talking about the poor who weren't using it. And you'll read some recipes where it requires a pound of spices for a recipe for 12 people. That's a ridiculous amount of spices for any kind of dish. Really, what it had to do with the two things. One, it was the taste of the time. And to explain that may be impossible about why we like particular tastes. The second reason was this new class of bourgeoisie often wanted to demonstrate its cultural and economic superiority to other classes by doing so through the consumption of goods. And one of those consumables was spices because it was so expensive. And remember that sugar was considered a spice as well at that particular period of time.
So it was being ostentatious.
Absolutely. I mean, just the way today, you hardly can go into a fancy restaurant in a major American city and not have something served with lobster and truffles and caviar.
Foie gras.
Exactly, yeah.
Are there dishes that you uncovered in researching this book that you're especially proud of, that date back or perhaps were in danger of becoming obsolete or lost?
Well, you know, to be honest, I think that most of the recipes in this book are probably in that category, because one of my major concerns was capturing this authentic cuisine. And my definition of authentic is, if you were to make a recipe out of this book and serve it to a native of that region, they would say to you, yes, this is it. That's as far as I would want to go with a definition of authentic, that the native would recognize the dish, that you would have done it correctly. So many of these dishes, I think, are rescued in a way, because some of them are not even being made anymore in people's homes. An example is in Lebanon and Syria and in Turkey, sunflower seed oil and Crisco is coming to replace olive oil in cooking because people think of it as being more modern, which I find is a development that's sort of sad in a way. It's very similar to the development in American cuisine when we gave up in the 1950s fresh vegetables for canned and frozen ones. It's a backward step, not a forward step. And you see this happening because people want to be modern, and there's a conception of what modern is. Not a conception that I necessarily agree with. But to answer your question about what recipe, I mean, I would say half the recipes here are probably being rescued, as far as I can tell. But there's a couple from Venice, which I had a lot of fun finding. And one is this this risotto that is made. It's a very heavy risotto. You would hardly want to serve it as a first course. It's really a main course, where it's made with this kind of cut from the spine. And you really can't find this anymore. So that was nice to find those kinds of recipes and have people help me develop them.
How did you research the book and track down these recipes?
Well, by traveling what seems like endlessly, and traveling on the cheap, too, I must say. But sometimes a recipe would come in the strangest way. There was a time I was flying to Cairo, I think from Rome. I'm not sure where I was flying from. And I was sitting next to an Egyptian dentist, and we got to talking. And I told him what I was doing, and he got so excited and immediately started giving me recipes as he remembered his mother making them. Well, when I finally got home, I tried them out, and they were terrific. So they're in the book now. That's one way. But the incredible thing about talking about food as you travel, no matter where you are, people just love the fact that you're interested in their food, in their culture, and genuinely interested, and doors open up. I mean, there would be some strange times of, the one I remember is I had arranged to live for about a week with an Egyptian peasant woman in Upper Egypt in a little village, a little house without electricity, a propane stove, no floor, just animals running the house, very poor people. But they had a TV, and I remember the first day we went over, I was surrounded by all of these Muslim women dressed in black, and here was me and my buddy, you know, in our Hawaiian shirts, and on the TV was the Cosby Show. And it was so bizarre to be in this incredibly primitive place, cooking with her, learning about Egyptian food in this peasant village, and at the same time to be these American guys, and you can't imagine how unusual it was to be a man hanging out with women in these Muslim countries. They just thought it was a hoot.
Clifford Wright, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Clifford Wright's new book, A Mediterranean Feast, is the winner of this year's James Beard Award for Cookbook of the Year. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on season finales. This is Fresh Air. Even though May isn't over, the television ratings period known as the May sweeps ended last night, which will mean a different sort of television for the next several months. TV critic David Bianculli looks at this year's season finales and the whole idea of season finales in general.
You know, back in the old days of TV, let's say the 60s and 70s, primetime series didn't end their seasons with flashy finales. Except for weekly soap opera shows like Peyton Place, they just ended, serving up an episode of Mannix or the Mary Tyler Moore Show that wasn't much different from the one the week before. But that was before shows like Hill Street Blues brought serialized storylines to the regular drama series, and programs like Dallas and Twin Peaks showed how you could get people buzzing all summer with the right cliffhanger mystery. Who shot J.R.? Who killed Laura Palmer? Those were the season finales that launched 1,000 ships, or at least 1,000 newspaper articles and magazine covers. Since then, almost every TV drama and an increasing number of the sitcoms have gotten into the season finale game. They're like dozens of kids running around the same community pool, all shouting, "Look at me! Look at me!" This trend has gotten out of hand, and for two reasons. One is that when every show proclaims itself as special, it's a harder sell. The other reason it's gotten out of hand is that with every show presenting and promoting its season finale, the overall effect is that all the six networks basically are reminding viewers they're about to close shop for the summer. Yes, there will be new summer series this year. After the astounding success ABC had last summer launching Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, you better believe it. But those favorite shows you've been watching faithfully since last fall? New episodes of those series won't be back until September. Actually, make that October, because NBC is covering the Olympics from Australia the last 2 weeks of September this year, so the networks won't be launching their new shows against that competition. So when we say goodbye to shows in May, we're waving goodbye for 5 months. And the networks wonder why their overall audience share erodes each year. As for specific finales this May, how many of them were worth it? Most of them, despite all the hype, delivered pretty much what was expected. Mulder was abducted by aliens on The X-Files, explaining why David Duchovny would be in fewer shows next season. Daphne and Niles finally committed to one another on Frasier, a move that will change the dynamic of a good but aging show that really needed a change. Chandler proposed to Monica on Friends, Bobby and Lindsay got married on The Practice, and Captain Janeway of Star Trek Voyager became the second starship captain to be turned into a Borg during a season-ending cliffhanger. Some finales this year were truly strange. Al Gore played a cartoon superhero version of himself in a what-if episode of Futurama, which is worth hearing just because it's so improbable.
Who are you people?
I'm Al Gore, and these are my vice presidential action rangers, a group of top nerds whose sole duty is to prevent disruptions in the space-time continuum.
I thought your sole duty was to cast the tie-breaking vote in the Senate.
That, and protect the space-time continuum. Read the Constitution.
And a sci-fi show called The Others on NBC ended its season by killing all its characters in an alternate reality dream state. Since NBC canceled the show, those characters, like the series, will remain dead. No big loss. Which finales worked the best? Aaron Sorkin served up two of them. On The West Wing, an already excellent episode ended with a sudden assassination attempt, and we'll have to wait until October to find out which characters got shot. And on his Sports Night sitcom, the season finale was built around a fear that the show within a show, also called Sports Night, would be canceled. At the end, a billionaire investor saves the day and tells the show's producer, played by Felicity Huffman, why.
You're keeping the station?
Yeah.
You're keeping the show?
Yeah. It's a good show, Dana. Anybody who can't make money off Sports Night should get out of the money-making business.
That's basically Aaron Sorkin delivering an author's message to ABC. And guess what? ABC canceled Sports Night anyway. Other excellent season finales this year included Once and Again, with its slow-motion walk to the front door, NYPD Blue, with Andy Sipowicz praying to God in a most emotional manner, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, with a dream world confrontation setting up lots of new possibilities for next season, and Roswell, with a cliffhanger that also changed the status quo for next year. And finally, though the entire episode didn't work as well as I'd hoped, I loved the final scene of the all-musical episode of Ally McBeal. The episode used almost a dozen old Randy Newman songs, and the closing selection was the best choice of all. James Naughton, who plays Ally's father, sat at the piano and serenaded his daughter with a beautifully sung rendition of Newman's A Real Emotional Girl, a song that predates Ally, but actually could have been written with that character in mind. I'll close with that, and with the hope that if we're stuck with the concept of season finales, at least they can all aspire to leave us with something worth remembering.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News.
She's a real emotional girl. Wears her heart on her sleeve. Every little thing you tell her, she'll believe. She really will. She even cries in her sleep. I've heard her many times before. Never have a girl who loves me half as much as this girl loves me. She's real emotional.
That's James Naughton singing the Randy Newman song, A Real Emotional Girl. Today's senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Captain Linda Greenlaw. She may well be the world's only woman swordboat captain. She talks about the challenges of commercial fishing off the Great Banks of Newfoundland. Her book, The Hungry Ocean, has just been released in paperback. And we talk to John Woo, director of the new film, Mission Impossible 2. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Mm-hmm.